No, said David. I want to pay the full price. I will not offer unto the Lord my God that which hath cost me nothing. I'd like you to look at that for a while. Here's a refreshing spectacle of a man refusing a cheap and costless religion. Every incident almost in the life of King David has a certain charm and manliness in it. For all his faultiness, David was every inch a king. And in this incidental bit of history, we get a little snapshot glimpse into his inner fineness, that nobility of soul in him, which has marked him as one of the colorful personages of history, and as the Bible says, a man after God's own heart. Get the setting. While David was out on some kind of safari in the countryside, he was moved by an impulse to set up an altar, make for himself a shrine where he might worship God and offer up a sacrifice. Out in that rural section, he sought and found a place that seemed to him suitable. Ornan the Jebusite, apparently a rich landowner in that part of the country, was busy threshing his wheat when the king approached him and requested the use of his harvest floor as a place for worship. Well, it isn't just every day that a king comes to a farmer's premises. And Ornan apparently was overwhelmed with the honor. Bowing low before the king, he offered to set at his disposal everything he wished. Certainly the king may use his barn for a church. Take it, he said. Do what is good in thine eyes. Lo, also, I give thee the oxen for the sacrifice, the wood for the fire, and wheat for the offering. I give it all. And then it is that David comes back with one of those high, colorful touches so characteristic of his inner fineness in response to this humble man's hospitality. His generous offer to provide without expense all the necessities for his sacrifice. David said, no. I want to pay for it. I want to pay the full price. I will not take what is thine for the Lord. I will not offer unto the Lord my God that which hath cost me nothing. I want you to look at that. That's the mark of a gentleman. The mark of a thoroughbred. Indeed, it is the prophetic quality of the true Christian approach to life. David simply scorned a religion that made no demands on him. He refused to be a religious hitchhiker. He wouldn't ride to town at another man's expense. I want to pay my way, he said. I want to put down the full price. I want to make my own contribution for that which I cherish as precious and worthwhile. Now, maybe this isn't the usual emphasis on Thanksgiving Day, but I'm quite sure it is the essence of true thanksgiving. Because gratitude isn't just an emotion of feeling good about things. It doesn't begin to have substance until it carries with it that sense of personal obligation, indebtedness, until it begins to talk like David. I want to make some contribution for this myself. George Bernard Shaw defined a gentleman as one who puts more into life than he takes out. And that's a simple definition and easy to carry around with you. I thought I'd like to have you look at this morning because it puts its finger on a certain quality of life which ought to be more in the lives of our people now than it is. You know, we could start away down at the bottom rung of the ladder, which this story itself suggests. We could talk about money here. Odd, isn't it, that this story should come precisely on Budget Sunday. I wonder how that happened. You know, we have some very spiritual people in our churches who dislike the mention of money in connection with worship. The collection plate in a church seems to jar on their sublimer emotions. They'd be quite willing for Orna or any Jebusite to supply the altar and pay the bills so that they could devote themselves to the very spiritual matters. Money to them is a kind of a mundane, certainly unspiritual substance. And so when the minister says, "Let us worship God in the offering," they don't think of it as an expression of their worship. They think of it as an interruption of their worship. They want to get it over with, get it out of the way as quickly as possible, so that they can turn their minds to think of God again and the high spiritual things. Well, you know, it must be wonderful to be so deeply spiritual because such religion goes away beyond the religion of the Bible. The Bible's very realistic about it. All through the books of the Old and New Testament, the religion of the people is bound up with the possessions of the people. What people did with their money and how they handled their material possessions was an index to what they were, and it was a test of their devotion. Jesus was interested in the collection plate. He sat over against the treasury to watch how people gave, where they were putting their devotions. Gladstone said, "If you know what a man thinks of his money, how he gets it, how he keeps it, how he spends it, you know some of the most important things about that man." Look out now, we're getting a little personal here. You find out what a man thinks about his money, how he gets it, how he keeps it, what he considers most important to spend it on, and you know the inner character of the man. That's a disturbing thought. Maybe it's a little too disturbing to hold in our minds too long, so let's get off of it now. But I think that all of us could learn something from this gentleman of the Old Testament. Who would not ride to town on another man's expense? "I want to pay my way," he said. I won't take what is thine for the Lord. I'm not going to offer unto the Lord my God that which hath made no demands on me." That's a pretty good thing to think about on Budget Sunday. A few years ago, the Associated Press carried a human interest story about the Metropolitan Methodist Church in Detroit when Dr. Merton S. Rice was the minister there. In a downtown office, two men were discussing religion. One of them announced his intention of joining Dr. Rice's church. "I wouldn't do that," his friend cautioned. "That's an expensive church they're building there. They'll soak you if you get in there." "They will? I never thought of that. I'll find out about it." So he called Dr. Rice on the telephone, arranged an appointment with him, and sitting in the church office with Dr. Rice, he related his conversation in the business office, asked him if there was any truth in the rumor downtown that Metropolitan Church was an expensive church to belong to. Dr. Rice looked at him a moment and said, "Yes, sir, they're right. This is an expensive church. If you join this church, we'll soak you. If you don't want to be soaked, don't come in here. And may God have mercy on whatever cheap gate you seek to enter." Well, the man looked the preacher straight in the eye. "Give me a card for admission. I'm coming in next Sunday." Well, The fact is, of course, that Metropolitan Church is no more expensive than any other church. You can go in and out of any church without much cost, if you want it that way. The poor and underprivileged are all around Metropolitan Church up there, and they're as welcome in its walls as they are in any church. But that preacher was right, and he was Christian, in refusing to encourage any following that could be lured by the promise of cheap transportation and costless devotion. And the man responded like a gentleman, with a new respect for something that he knew was going to make demands on him. And I am convinced that we often underestimate people, that they're often disappointed that we ask too little, make it seem too small, and often ready to go much further than we ask, because there's something in every person like that nobility in David. I want to pay my way. I don't want to take what belongs to you for the Lord. I want to make my own contribution for that which I cherish as precious and worthwhile. But now we come to it, and we must walk up the rungs of this unseen ladder into the realm of values that money cannot pay for. Not with money, nor any checkbook, however yielded, can we purchase the most costly possessions of life. Thanksgiving Day comes around each year reminding us of unnumbered mercies, unconsidered blessings which merit our gratitude, make demands on us, and which cause us, like the psalmist, to say, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits." You notice that he was quite modest about that. He didn't ask that every blessing be remembered. He just didn't want to forget them all. By far the biggest part of our lives is what we call heritage. That which comes to us not of our own making, or out of our own wisdom, or out of our own effort, but that which comes to us unearned, through the goodness of God, his faithfulness, and through the effort and the spirit and love of other people. Here we are in the 20th century, as though all the ages behind us were like an Ornan standing on his threshing floor, saying to us, "Lo, I give it all to thee." How rich we are in heritage. And you see, Thanksgiving is little more than mockery, little more than hypocrisy, to when it's nothing more than a sentiment, a feeling good about things, congratulating ourselves on our good fortune, glorying in our heritage, and patting ourselves on the back that we're wise enough and good enough to be born in America, like the Pharisee thanking God he wasn't like other men. Thanksgiving doesn't begin to have Christian moral content until it begins to talk like David. "I want to make some contribution for this. I will not take the heritage of the ages as a handout. I want to put something back for what I've taken out." And with that in mind, let us look then at our heritage, our spiritual heritage first, of which the coming of the pilgrims still stands as the abiding symbol. We can't forget that picture. Dr. Harvey Branscombe, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University, wrote an article for a religious periodical on the meaning of the New Testament. And in it, he traced the spread of New Testament ideas through the North American continent. And it was well done. Thanksgiving Day reminds us of that. That culturally, this new world didn't start from scratch, without background, without ancestral roots. It was settled here out of the ferment of the old world and by people with deep religious convictions, though they were poverty poor in other sources of culture, they did have the Bible, the mother of culture, and they spread those ideas here. They brought in their minds a great concept of God, nourished through many centuries of revelation. They brought in their hearts a great devotion to Christ, which was kindled in them by the Reformation. They brought in their hands an open book with its history of ideas rooted in the religious, the spiritual concept of life. And the writings of this book, through them, were spread abroad, became the great influencing factor in the life of the North American continent. It was an old story, but he did it so well. It is largely a Protestant heritage when you stop to think of it. And when I say that, I don't want to claim too much. I know that Roman Catholics have made their contribution here, that Judaism has both directly and indirectly made its contribution here. One reason a rabbi will stand in this pulpit on Thanksgiving morning is the feeling that Thanksgiving Day didn't begin in America. Long before America, there were people who observed Thanksgiving Day. The Jews were the first to inaugurate Thanksgiving Day. We're not underestimating the contribution of any other faith. But when we say it is largely a Protestant heritage, we mean this, that it is largely through the Protestant movement that the open Bible was loosed in American life, because the open Bible was a product of the Reformation. And in lands where the Roman branch of the church has held sway over these years, like Cuba, Mexico, South America, Quebec, the Bible, for the most part, is a closed book to the people. But here its ideas were spread. Its phrases were woven into common speech. Its ideas were written into political documents and institutions. Even its names were spread like confetti all over this wilderness. When a baby was born or a new village sprang up, those early Protestant Americans ransacked the Bible from cover to cover to find suitable names with which to baptize them properly. Last summer, I spoke at a Bible conference in Mount Gretna, Pennsylvania, and the man who drove me down to the station knew Pennsylvania like a book. He asked me what I was going to do next summer. And I told him I didn't know yet, that it was our 25th anniversary in this church, and I knew the people were raising a fund to send us on a trip somewhere, and I may even go to Palestine. And he said, you don't need to. You can visit almost every place of Palestine right here in Pennsylvania. Well, you know that. You go through Pennsylvania or New England or Ontario or any state in the Southland, you'd think that this new world was once the scene of a Hebrew invasion. Bethlehem, Bethel, Mizpah, Sharon, Providence. Well, you go down the list. How many of you here have Bible names? I'd be interested in that. I think it wouldn't hurt to put up your hand quickly if you have Bible names. Look at them. All over. Where'd you get them? Back in the New England village, you know, almost every prophet from Daniel to Ezekiel could be found playing on the village green, while Deborah and Dorcas and Miriam and Mary and Rebecca and Martha were in the kitchen and looking on and giggling. You know how that is. You go back there and see. When they ran out of Bible names, they took Bible virtues. Prudence, grace, faith, hope. William Brewster, leader of the Pilgrims, had a son named Love Brewster and two daughters, Fear and Patience Brewster. I read of one family back there in which there were 9 girls, all of them with Bible names, Temperance, Joy, Faith, Hope, so on. And when the 10th daughter came, they had a name to fit her. They called her Sufficient. Well, it's easy to belittle the Puritans with their Sabbath keeping and their stern morality. Most of their history today is being written by the Impuritans. And one of the silliest things ever written about them was in a local newspaper last week. It's easy to belittle the Puritans. But they brought here a concept of life that leaves us incalculably in their debt. Through home and church and school, they spread these New Testament ideas that every man has dignity before God. Every man has dignity before God. That the purpose of life is not the accumulation of things, but the making of good men and women. That it's blessed to be merciful and just and pure in spirit. That every man is his own priest. In heart and conscience free. This is our spiritual heritage. These are the ideas which have nourished here our way of life. They are in our moral climate. They are in the tissue of our thinking, the most relevant and effective interpretation of God and life to be found anywhere in the earth. But how can we give thanks for this heritage? You know that people today are writing books on the decline of Protestantism? What's the matter with Protestantism? And we know, at least a part of the answer is that we have too many Protestants taking too much for granted, living on the spiritual heritage of a believing past with no sense of indebtedness and making no contribution of their own. I believe that if a religious census were taken of any city on this continent, including ours, it would reveal that there are literally thousands of people who call themselves Protestants, who don't know what Protestantism is, who are not identified with any church, who are doing nothing to keep this heritage or pass it on. Here in our own church, here right in our own locality, we have children, of course, in the Sunday school whose parents are in the church, but we have more than 300 whose parents belong to no church at all. Churchless Protestants. That's one reason. They're like the English squire whose obituary notice read, "He had no interest in religion, But in all other matters, he was a consistent Protestant. A Protestant with no interest in religion. Now, that's something to think about. Channing Pollock told us about it in one of those "Why I Don't Go to Church" pieces some years ago. Said he was a very religious man, but he didn't go to church. No sermon was worth listening to, and besides, he could get closer to God out there on the golf course. To which somebody in the next issue made answer, "It must be wonderful to be so spiritually superior. And in a Christian civilization, may be possible to live a moral life apart from the sources. But we ought to be too proud to draw thus on the bank of the past. We ought to be too proud to draw thus on the bank of the past. It's largely these churchless homes, Catholic and Protestant, from which our juvenile delinquency comes, divorce, break up of homes and the breakdown of life. We cannot go on using up the moral capital of a believing past without running into this kind of moral bankruptcy and spiritual emptiness." I have here a verse written by a well-known woman of America and a very worldly woman who belonged to the breed of Protestants who, like Channing Pollock, lived in detachment from the source of morality. She said, "Back to the church of my fathers I went. The years away had been long, seeking an accrual of faith to make my spirit strong. I looked about me and I saw humble, devout folk there, lifting reverent faces up and drawing strength from prayer. But no funds of faith were there for me, only emptiness and doubt. For years, I had put nothing in. What could I hope to draw out?" What is needed in our thanksgiving is a more gentlemanly gratitude. We dare not hitchhike our way on another generation's push. We must go out after these delinquent, detached Protestants and challenge them with this. Here in our own community, we must do it. We must say to them, "Come on into our churches and help us, because if we are to hold this high heritage here, we must all begin to talk a bit like David. I will not take what is thine for the Lord. I want to make some deposit of my own." Well, now, exactly the same thing is true of another heritage, which on the surface, at least, is political. Thanksgiving Day reminds us that this nation was born in freedom, nourished, cradled in the principle of liberty. Those pilgrims came from a long line of men and women who in the old world had been pushed around by kings and rulers, popes, bishops, tyrants, overlords. Mainly that's why they came here, freedom. They wanted to make here a commonwealth of free men, where every man was his own priest, standing upright before God and uncringing before men. Nobody pushed around. And before they got off the boat, before they landed in that wonderful Mayflower compact, they had set the enduring pattern of this nation's political history. Since that far-off day, the American dream has gone through many changes and many conflicts. But the essence of it remains exactly the same. The North American idea, said Walter Lippmann, is exactly the same today as it was in the beginning. The right of free men to govern themselves. And we glory in that political heritage. We make a boast of it. But how are we to be properly thankful for it? To stand here feeling good about it, congratulating ourselves on our good fortune, patting ourselves on the back that we were wise enough and good enough to be born in the land of the free and let the rest of the world go by? Surely, surely it's coming home to us now that when all the old tyrannies are trying desperately everywhere to come back, even here, that we need to bring to this heritage of freedom a more gentlemanly gratitude. We dare not take it for granted anymore. Thumb a ride on another generation's dream. For freedom is never a finished thing, fixed and final forever, to be passed on like real estate from one generation to another. Somebody said, the struggle for freedom is not like a 100-yard dash in which you win the cup and put it up in the cupboard as a permanent possession. It's more like a relay race in which every generation takes it up, every generation pays down the cost and carries it into lands unconquered and unachieved. Last week, somebody sent me a newspaper from Australia telling of the churches there going out to the people with exactly this challenge. They are saying, we dare not stop on what our fathers have won for us. The idea of freedom we must carry to the whole world and not rest until we do. It reminded me of a fascinating story of James Tyson. I wonder if you've heard that. James Tyson was a very wealthy man, an Australian. But he had no interest in just feathering his own nest and settling down in the comfort of his wealth. He was a gentleman. He was grateful for what his country had done for him. And he stood there thankful for it and moved by that sense of indebtedness, the impulse of gratitude. He set about making his contribution. And the one thing that flamed in his heart was a desire to beat back the desert, to irrigate the desert, to bend a river around here and tap a mountain lake there and release a stream of life-giving water over lands which for generations had been nothing but dead dust. One day, while he was crossing the desert in a railway train, he fell into conversation with a sort of playboy character whose conversation was exhausted when he had talked about the last football game, who had run the longest yardage and how much money he had won on the game and so on. And then he finally got around to asking Mr. Tyson, what is your sport? What game do you play? I, said James Tyson, I fight the desert. The desert? Yes, sir. Looking out the window. All my life, I've been fighting that big, dry, challenging thing. And I've been winning, too. Look, see some of the lines I've crossed. Talk about 10 yards to go. Look at some of the things we've won. We put water where no water was. We built roads where no roads were. We planted grain where no verdure grew. We've been fighting back the desert, planting grass right up to its receding edge. And when I die, I want my body to be buried on the last edge of the retreating desert where I pushed it. I've fought it up to here. Now others must come. Take up the fight and beat the desert back. Back out of existence. Well, so it is with the great desert of tyranny and human oppression. Our fathers won their battle. They fought it up to here. But their dream is not enough for us. We can't settle down on what they've won or be satisfied with their victory. We must dream our own dream. They brought freedom to the new world. We must take it to the whole world. Not stop, not quit, until every man is free. Impossible? Sure it is. So it seems. But that's exactly what they said back there. They said that same thing back there. Free men to govern themselves, impossible, it never will happen. And if it does, it won't hold, it won't stay. And yet here we are, standing here today, thanking God for people who, with their courage and their vision and their stick-to-itiveness and their faith in God, pushed back the desert. Made an impossible dream come true. Do we have people today who will say to them, we will not take what is thine for the Lord. We will take up your fight. We will take it up from here. We'll push back the desert. We'll make some contribution in our time. It was a great poem that Canadian poet wrote in the First World War. In Flanders fields where poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, we are the dead. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to bear it high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep in Flanders fields where poppies grow. Do you know of any other way to honor our fathers and express thanksgiving?
This is the end of this side. Please turn your cassette over for the beginning of side two.